It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
International community ramps up response to West Africa's Ebola epidemic. U.S. dispatches troops as death toll rises to near 2,500. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. The international community is increasing its response to West Africa's Ebola epidemic. Tuesday, the World Health Organization announced a revised death toll approaching 2,500. Speaking at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, President Obama Tuesday said the deadly virus has the potential to threaten global security.
If the outbreak is not stopped now, we could be looking at hundreds of thousands of people infected, with profound political and economic and security implications for all of us. So this is an epidemic that is not just a threat to regional security, it's a potential threat to global security. If these countries break down, if their economies break down, if people panic, that has profound effects on all of us, even if we are not directly contracting the disease.
Mr. Obama is dispatching 3,000 troops, including engineers and medical personnel, establishing a regional command and control center in Liberia, creating a distribution center in Senegal, and building 17 100-bed treatment centers. That's welcome news to Liberian student Viola Richards.
I think with that, Liberia will be free from Ebola and will live in one peace and harmony and will be free to move around happy with our family once again. So I just want to say thank you, a big, big thank you to the U.S. government.
The disease has also hit Sierra Leone hard, with more than 560 people who have died since March, and Guinea, where the epidemic has cost nearly 600 lives. Nigeria has had 8 Ebola-related fatalities since late July. The Democratic Republic of Congo has been hit by a separate strain of the virus, which has killed 39 people, including 8 healthcare workers. This is VOA News. The UN Security Council is set to adopt a resolution urging countries to provide field hospitals and other urgent aid to West Africa over Ebola. The Council's hearing is set for Thursday. On Tuesday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called for an end to travel restrictions.
We cannot allow bans on travel or transport to slow us down. We need isolation of people affected by Ebola, not of nations struggling to cope with it. This is not just a health crisis. It has grave humanitarian, economic, and social consequences that could spread far beyond and affected countries.
In Geneva Tuesday, the World Health Organization warned the numbers of those dying and infected could double every 3 weeks, and the crisis could cost the globe nearly $1 billion. WHO official Dr. Bruce Aylward said the Ebola epidemic is unparalleled in modern times.
We have not seen Ebola in large urban centers like we see it now. We have not seen numbers escalate like we're seeing them today, which means this roadmap works if it's implemented today, with a huge surge of international assistance and national assistance on the ground, a huge engagement of the communities in the implementation of some of these strategies, and with that, hopefully, a turning in this epidemic and a dropping of disease.
In the United States, a key safety trial for an experimental Ebola vaccine manufactured by GlaxoSmithKline and monitored by the U.S. government has been used successfully on 10 volunteers. An additional 10 volunteers will receive the vaccine in coming days. It doesn't contain the actual virus, but only one of its genes. Officials hope the trial period will end successfully before the year is out. The new president of the U.N. General Assembly, Ugandan Foreign Minister Sam Kutesa, said Tuesday the year ahead will be momentous during the world body's 69th session.
One of the priorities I highlighted for this session is continuing focus on the revitalization of the General Assembly and the reform of Security Council.
He will preside over the opening of the General Assembly next week, involving 140 nations. He said the meeting takes place at a time of tumultuous change, with UN goals of fighting poverty and preserving the environment. In Libya, Reuters reports clashes Tuesday between forces loyal to a retired general and Islamist fighters in Benghazi left at least 9 dead, wounded 30 others. Islamist gunmen are trying to gain control of the city's airport. Nigerian lawmakers Tuesday said they'll meet President Goodluck Jonathan to urge him to declare total war on Boko Haram. Mr. Jonathan in May vowed a total war against terrorism following the abduction of hundreds of schoolgirls. Russia and Zimbabwe Tuesday signed a $3 billion agreement to jointly mine platinum, with Moscow providing investment funding. It's expected to generate up to 8,000 jobs. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. President Barack Obama is sending U.S. troops to assist Ebola-stricken West Africa.
At the request of the Liberian government, we're going to establish a military command center in Liberia to support civilian efforts across the region, similar to our response after the Haiti earthquake.
The United Nations Refugee Agency says more money is needed to help thousands of Nigerians displaced by Boko Haram. South Sudan bans foreign workers ordering their jobs to be given to South Sudanese. And a DRC rebel leader says his forces want protection for civilians before handing over their weapons.
We say we are ready to support the government by bringing peace and security in the area where our troops are controlling. That's a different area. But the only condition that the government guarantee our troops peace and security for their families.
Didier Bitaki is leader of the Mai Mai Kifuafua armed group in the Democratic Republic of Congo. A Kenyan entrepreneur seeks to save the environment while empowering his community. And Nelson Mandela's Freedom Torch is set for auction in Boston, the United States. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama is sending thousands of U.S. troops to support health services in West Africa, where nearly 2,500 people have now died from an Ebola outbreak. After meeting with health experts Tuesday at the headquarters of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, Mr. Obama said Ebola is not just a threat to regional security, but a potential threat to global security. He said the world looks up to the United States to take leadership in the fight against Ebola. Mr. Obama outlined an expanded U.S. response.
At the request of the Liberian government, we're going to establish a military command center in Liberia to support civilian efforts across the region, similar to our response after the Haiti earthquake. And our forces are going to bring their expertise in command and control, in logistics, in engineering. We're going to create an air bridge to get health workers and medical supplies into West Africa faster. We're going to establish a staging area in Senegal to help distribute personnel and aid on the ground more quickly. We are going to create a new training site to train thousands of health workers so they can effectively and safely care for more patients. Personnel from the U.S. Public Health Service will deploy to the new field hospitals that we're setting up in Liberia. And USAID will join with international partners and local communities in a community care campaign to distribute supplies and information kits to hundreds of thousands of families so they can better protect themselves. We're also going to build additional treatment units, including new isolation spaces and more than 1,000 beds. And in all our efforts, the safety of our personnel will remain a top priority. Meanwhile, our scientists continue their urgent research in the hope of finding new treatments and perhaps vaccines. And today I'm calling on Congress to approve the funding that we've requested so that we can carry on with all these critical efforts.
President Obama said the West Africa Ebola crisis is a global threat that demands a global response.
The scenes that we're witnessing in West Africa today are absolutely gut-wrenching. In one account over the weekend, we read about a family in Liberia. The disease had already killed the father, the mother was cradling a sick and listless 5-year-old son. Her other son, 10 years old, was dying too. They finally reached a treatment center, but they couldn't get in and said, a relative, we're just sitting. You know, these men and women and children are just sitting, waiting to die right now. And it doesn't have to be this way. The reality is that this epidemic is going to get worse before it gets better, but right now, the world still has an opportunity to save countless lives. Right now, the world has the responsibility to act, to step up, and to do more.
Mr. Obama assured Americans that U.S. medical experts at the CDC have said that the chances of an Ebola outbreak here in the United States are extremely low.
We've been taking the necessary precautions, including working with countries in West Africa to increase screening at airports so that someone with the virus doesn't get on a plane for the United States. In the unlikely event that someone with Ebola does reach our shores, we've taken new measures so that we're prepared here at home. We're working to help flight crews identify people who are sick, and more labs across our country now have the capacity to quickly test for the virus. We're working with hospitals to make sure that they are prepared and to ensure that our doctors, our nurses, and our medical staff are trained, are ready, and are able to deal with a possible case safely.
U.S. President Barack Obama speaking Tuesday at the headquarters of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia. The U.N. Refugee Agency is urgently appealing for $34 million to help tens of thousands of people forced to flee their homes in the face of increasingly violent attacks by Boko Haram in northeast Nigeria. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
While 75,000 people have fled into Cameroon, Chad, and Niger to escape vicious onslaughts by Boko Haram, the UNHCR says it expects that number to increase to at least 95,000 by the end of the year. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baloche says there is not enough shelter to accommodate the influx of refugees into Cameroon. He says those newly arrived are occupying school buildings and churches. Some are staying with host families, and others are living in the open and sleeping rough.
Over the past weekend, newly arrived refugees told our teams at the border area that insurgents had attacked their villages in the areas of Gwaza, Bama, Pulka, and Itagala in the Borno state, and stole everything before burning their houses. Some refugees are seriously traumatized, having seen their relatives being brutally killed.
He says the refugees escaped their homes at night and walked for days before reaching Cameroon. He says the children are exhausted, with many suffering from respiratory infections. He says the villages are mostly empty on the Nigeria side, with only old and disabled people remaining. The UNHCR spokesman tells VOA insurgent groups have been known to chase fleeing refugees into Cameroon. He says cross-border attacks appear to have subsided.
But one of UNHCR's main concerns is to relocate all the arriving refugees from the border areas to the camps and further inland. But people who arrive are quite desperate and traumatized because, as I was mentioning, some of them have seen their relatives being killed. We have heard some gruesome details in terms of how these people have been murdered.
Nigerian authorities are asking the agency's support to better protect nearly 650,000 people internally displaced in the six northeastern states. The UNHCR is appealing for an additional $5.5 million to set up a protection monitoring system to provide shelter and domestic items to displaced people with special needs. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The leader of the Mai Mai Kifuafua rebel movement says he needs assurances from the Democratic Republic of Congo's government that it will protect unarmed citizens in the territory under his group's control before his 2,800 members can hand over their weapons under the administration's peace program. Didier Bitaki tells reporter Peter Clotty his rebel group is ready to support government's peace effort, but he said the DRC government has yet to keep promises that it made to protect civilians.
We could not leave our people being killed by FDLR and the other groups which are allied to Rwanda forces. We can't do that. So it's very simple. If the government guarantees security to our population in Walikale and other areas, there is no condition for my troops to join the government. But because there is no security for our population, that's the reason why we maintain a force to secure, because we did the same, but we did not. We were deceived by the government.
You don't have the mandate under the Constitution. It is only the FARDC. Why don't you continue to work with the government to bring peace to the area as part of the DDR program supported by the international community, which in case is MONUSCO?
64 article of the Constitution says that everybody has a right to defend himself whenever he's threatened by foreign or external forces that is just making his life in danger. So that's the Congolese constitution. And then what do we see? We saw that our families were just threatened by rebels, forces from Rwanda and from anywhere. we said that we should protect ourselves because the FRDC were not able to do so. So that is the reason why that group exists. We said, okay, we are ready to support the government by implementing peace, bringing peace and security in the area where our troops are controlling just the different areas. But the only condition that the government guarantee our troops peace and security for their families. Only that if the government that meets that condition.
But the government is implementing the DDR program as part of an effort to ensure peace and stability in areas like Walikale and North Kivu province. Why wouldn't you give the government the chance for 2,800 of your members who are armed?
Where are they, please? We need to see the troops be deployed in different areas where our populations were killed by FDLR and by other forces allied to run these forces. You see, that is not the question. So there is no way we can see that the troops leave the places where they are, and then tomorrow or after tomorrow, people are killed because there is no security. We are asking for the government to deploy in different areas where Mai-Mai are deployed so that, to be sure that tomorrow or after tomorrow, our families will be in peace.
Didier Bitaki is the leader of the Mai-Mai Kifuafua armed group in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotet from Walikale in the DRC. It is Wednesday morning, September 17th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 17 minutes past the hour. South Sudan's government has ordered all non-governmental organizations, private companies, and businesses operating in the country to fire their employees of foreign origin by mid-October and hire South Sudanese. The order from the Minister of Labor, Public Service, and Human Resources applies to banks, insurance companies, hotels, and lodges. But as Philip Alour reports from Juba, this is not the first time that the government has issued such an order.
Minister of Labor and Public Service, Ngor Kulang Ngor, who issued the order, says it is aimed at protecting the rights and the interests of the people of South Sudan. Helen Achiro, the Undersecretary, Ministry of Labor and Public Service, says the order simply implements existing employment guidelines, which are often ignored by NGOs and private companies.
For instance, if you take a position of head of human resource, the fact that it's being filled by non-national, in most cases, they do not bother to fulfill the policy of the government. And so government felt it would make sense if we have national, because the national would be able to urge the management to make sure that they are compliant to the government policy.
Achiro says there are thousands of qualified South Sudanese to fill the jobs at companies around the country.
Some of the organization has got those old days whereby we were in a deep war situation where most of our intellectuals, they were either in the front line or they are in the diaspora. But this today, as we speak, is totally different. We have our national who had been studying outside. They have got the necessary qualifications that is required. And to our dismay, you find that such kind of national, when they apply, they would be told, we do not have a place for you at the moment.
One official at an international insurance company says out of 70 employees, only 11 are not South Sudanese at this company. The official, wished to remain anonymous, says he is surprised the government expects the position of executive director to be given to locals. He says there are certain positions which cannot be filled by South Sudanese because of their limited level of qualifications. Achiru says in the event that there is no qualified national for a particular job, the company will have another option.
We would give work permit on condition that the establishment attach a national who is already either working with them or has to be recruited, who will be mentored by this person.
Achiro insists the government is not targeting foreigners.
It does not imply at any single time that the Republic of South Sudan do not want foreigners to work in their country. That is not the case. The issue is we need to balance this equation. Simply because during the war, a lot, even more than three quarters of the human resource working, they were all foreigners.
Achiro says government jobs are open to all qualified South Sudanese. For BOA News, I am Philip Tonaleu in Juba.
Lona Ruto, a former banker, is now an enviropreneur who is turning plastic waste into furniture and fences. Lenny Ruvaga talks with Ruto on the challenges faced in Africa with raw materials and the environment and files this report from Nairobi, Kenya.
30-year-old Nicodemus Muli is in the final stages of making a recycled plastic post. 3 years ago, Muli joined EcoPost, an environmental company that recycles plastic waste into usable products.
I like working in EcoPost plastic processing because it helps me to bring up my family. Yeah. And on top of that, it helps us to clean the environment. Yeah, and to make posts which are less harmful to the environment.
Before the plastic becomes poles, it goes through a series of steps. The plastic is first shredded into tiny bits in an industrial shredder. Muli then mixes the shredded plastic in a trough, where it is heated to compact the shredded bits. Finally, the plastic mold is dipped in water to cool. EcoPost began in 2009, and since then, the company says it has preserved more than 350 acres of forests by selling 30,000 plastic posts. The plant, located in Babadogo on the outskirts of Nairobi, produces 110 posts daily. Post costs approximately $7. A report released last July by the United Nations Environment Programme states that reducing, recycling, and redesigning products that use plastics can bring multiple green economy benefits. Environmentalist Roland Simiyu spoke to VOA about the benefits of recycling.
Recycling reduces the amount of waste discarded. It creates job opportunities, and it also reduces the amount of energy consumption. Now, for future sustainability of environment, it means people have to check their habit of consuming goods and services.
In 2009, Lona Ruto pooled around $4,000 from her savings, family, and friends to begin EcoPost. Since then, the enviropreneur has created more than 550 direct and indirect job opportunities.
That was reporter Lenny Ruvaga in Nairobi, Kenya. Nelson Mandela's Freedom Torch, used during a historic ceremony in 1994 to symbolize the end of apartheid in South Africa, is up for auction this week in the United States. Mariama Diallo reports.
2 decades ago, at the gates of Victor Verster Prison, hundreds gathered to hear former political prisoner Nelson Mandela begin a campaign to end white minority rule in South Africa. In his right hand, the anti-apartheid icon held a special torch that symbolized that quest for freedom.
This torch was used on February 2nd, 1994, outside of Victor Verster Prison, where Nelson Mandela announced to the world that he was running for president of South Africa against de Klerk. And this is the torch that lit the flame of freedom.
Bobby Livingston is with RR Auction, the company putting that torch up for bidding this week in Boston. As a token of appreciation and unity, Mr. Mandela gave it to a man named James David Sansom, a white worker who helped assemble the platforms and staging for that particular rally. Sansom kept the torch until he died 7 years ago.
When I saw it, it was stunning because the charcoal remnants of the flame from that day are still in there, and they're loose, but you can smell it. It's like you could still smell this torch and the fire that it started.
RR Auction used photographic and video evidence and interviewed several eyewitnesses to confirm that this was the actual torch. One of those interviewed was former Robben Island prisoner, now political leader, Monsieur Lokoda, known then as Terror Lokoda.
The reason we reached out to him, because there's right next to Mandela on the stage, is the young Terror Lokoda, an eyewitness to this incredible event.
Lokoda was one of many around the world who paid tribute to President Mandela when he passed away in December of last year. He wrote these words to RR Auction about the torch. Quote, I feel in my hand today, after all the years that have passed, the weight of the torch of freedom and the added responsibility it gave me in carrying it that day after being in the grip of the inimitable Nelson Mandela. Livingston adds that Sansom family members say they would like the symbolic piece to be curated or go to a museum. Bidding for the 53-centimeter metal torch will start at $50,000. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with netball. Hosts Botswana beat Namibia 49-36 as Uganda pipped Zimbabwe 53-52 at the Africa Netball World Cup qualifiers in Gaborone on Tuesday. Today, Wednesday, Botswana play Uganda, Namibia face Zambia, and Zimbabwe tackle Swaziland. With Kenya and Tanzania failing to arrive for the competition, the organizers changed the competition format to a round-robin contest. In football news, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, clarified in Cairo, Egypt on Tuesday that the suspension of football matches in Guinea following the outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus remains in force, contrary to media speculation in Guinea's capital, Conakry. CAF suspended football in the Mano River region to limit the spread of the Ebola virus that is ravaging communities in Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone. CAF Executive Committee will review the situation at their meeting in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia this coming weekend. On a more promising note, Nigeria Football Federation Secretary General Ahmed Musa told the media in Abuja on Tuesday that they will hold the first of two extraordinary Congress meetings in Warri, Delta State, South Nigeria on Saturday, as directed by the World Football Governing Body, FIFA. Musa clarified that the first General Assembly will pave the way for a second extraordinary Congress to elect a new NFF board. The election of a new NFF board was at the center of the turmoil that recently gripped Nigerian football, with FIFA threatening to suspend Nigeria from international football. The uncertain and tense situation significantly affected the campaign of the African champions and Nigeria Super Eagles in their first two group qualifiers for the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations. Finally, in swimming, Tunisian Haitham Abdelkhalik clocked 1 hour, 29 minutes and 50 seconds to win the 7.5-kilometer French Open Water Cup in Hostens-Gerdeen in southern France. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. U.S. President Barack Obama Tuesday announced the deployment of thousands of U.S. troops to bolster health services in West Africa, where nearly 2,500 people have now died in the Ebola outbreak. That is it for this Wednesday, September 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I am James Butt in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, African leaders countrywide have long sought a solution to the so-called brain drain, losing their brightest young minds to jobs in the West or Asia. Now many talented African students who study abroad are finding opportunities to apply their skills at home. We'll examine a new trend among Africa's top intellectual talent. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. That's right. Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked. VOA Africa, don't miss.